Welcome back to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. This is our weekly Q&A with Layla. Layla Mudin is our Hoffman Center nutritionist, and each week we get together and answer questions from our listening audience. Part one was our previous podcast, and now we're into part two. So, additional questions, Layla?
Yes, we have one. This is over the email, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. Could you please suggest any supplement most helpful to prevent blood clots during long plane flights and car rides besides fish oil? We will be doing seat exercises on the plane and be aware of walks to the restroom. Many thanks and keep up the exceptional work. That was from Terry.
Right. Well, it so happens that there is a supplement that precisely does that, and in fact, that's backed up by experimental evidence. And that supplement is pycnogenol. So pycnogenol is an OPC. It's an oligonoproanthocyanidin. And the OPCs include pine bark extract, which that's essentially what pycnogenol is. This is something that was discovered first in 1947 by a French doctor, Dr. Jacques Masquelier, and he lived in the south of France, and he discovered that the bark of the French maritime pine, it's a little twisty, kind of stunted-looking pine that withstands the hot and windy conditions of the maritime Alps in the south of France. Apparently, the plant makes its own natural protective antioxidants to help it withstand the rigors of this windy, dry, sometimes very hot, sometimes very cold climate. And so the OPCs are very concentrated in pine bark. You can also get them from grapeseed.
Grapeseed extract.
And there's a lot of grapeseed in the world because there's a lot of wine, and so they used to say, what the heck are we going to do with this grapeseed? Well, they make it into animal feed, but then they discovered a way to make even more money out of it because it's rich in OPCs, oligoproanthocyanins. And the latest finding I find quite interesting is that chocolate may deliver its heart healthy benefits via its OPC content.
So that's your favorite.
Yeah, so it always comes back to chocolate. Give me yet another rationale for eating dark chocolate. So, but pycnogenol absolutely does help reduce blood clots. It is, however, something that is not going to cause excessive bleeding, unlike high doses of fish oil. It can sometimes cause bruising. And it's a very helpful thing for not just preventing blood clots, but improving the elasticity and responsiveness of blood vessels, protecting the endothelium, which is the lining of the blood vessels. There's a lot of evidence that it's anti-inflammatory. So it's a wonderful supplement. It can be a little pricey, but it's well worth taking a few days before, during, and in the immediate aftermath of a plane flight. And, oh, by the way, keep getting up and walking around. And hydrate. That's actually one of the reasons they give you. They make you – it's like, why are you giving me so many beverages on this darn plane? It makes me want to go to the bathroom, and that's a nuisance on the plane. Then I got to get up, and there's always the lights on, and you got to wait in the aisle. Nervously looking around, hoping that they won't put on the turbulence light, go back to your seat. But there's a reason they give you all that hydration on planes, because the atmosphere in a cabin is very dry. And also, they realize that you're at higher risk of having blood clots. Yeah. And when your blood is hyper-concentrated, when you're dehydrated, you have a higher risk of having a blood clot. So this is actually one of the safety measures that they undertake during a flight. They want to, it's not just that they're so generous. They want to give you all this water and drinks. They actually want to prevent problems. So they do provide beverages on flights, which is a good idea.
Dr. Hoffman, what do you think about natokinase for this, or natokinase versus aspirin for this? Would that even be a recommendation?
Well, I would recommend aspirin for anyone who has either a previous incident of a blood clot, or there are actually blood tests that we can do that determine whether people have a hereditary susceptibility to blood clots. So sometimes when a person has a blood clot, we do a battery of tests and we find out that they're lacking a certain factor, or they have a hereditary predisposition. And these are people who need preventive anticoagulation, sometimes as much as Coumadin, but usually just aspirin will do to prevent blood clots. I have no problem with people taking aspirin to prevent blood clots. The problem is with aspirin, even the lowest doses, they can sometimes cause stomach irritation and even ulcers. So to tell everybody who's taking a plane to take an aspirin, we might prevent a few blood clots, but we'd also probably give a lot of people ulcers.
Mm.
Unnecessarily.
Okay. And nattokinase, is it a contender?
I think it's a contender, yeah. I'm just thinking that, it's up there. I mean, if you want to go, you know, for maximal protection, you can take additional vitamin E, and you can take ginkgo biloba, which also helps with altitude. And, you know, the pressure in the cabin is actually equivalent to several thousand feet of altitude. It's actually only partially pressurized, not to the pressure of sea level, but to the pressure of relatively high altitude. So if you want to counteract the effects of high altitude, ginkgo biloba is helpful. It's a little bit of a blood thinner. And
all that ear popping that happens,
I don't know if it's going to do that, because that's a pressure. Yeah. The ginkgo is not going to help that, but it will help blood circulate to the brain. It may help somewhat reduce the risk of blood clots. And ginkgo, by the way, is something you may not want to take during surgery, because it does thin the blood appreciably and may be contraindicated right at the time of surgery.
Yeah. Okay. Let's see here. Oh, I have one. Oh, this comes all the way from Johannesburg, South Africa.
Oh, excellent. Excellent. And you know, that is so amazing. You know, with the reach of the internet, we're getting so many responses from people all over the world. And by the way, this is a great way to learn English, because we talk real good on this show. just talk the way we talk on this show, and you will be talking perfect English.
Toid.
Right.
Okay. This is from Hope in South Africa, Johannesburg. And she's a student, and she was researching about, she calls it acetric acid and kidney stones, but I believe she means citric acid and kidney stones. So I would like to know how many people have been helped by citric acid.
Big time.
We
know this. I mean, even conventional urologists use something called polycitra K, which is a potassium citrate. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, is a standard treatment for calcium oxalate kidney stones, which is the most common type of kidney stone.
Magnesium citrate is also helpful.
Exactly. We like magnesium citrate because most people are actually low in magnesium. Plus, magnesium has an additional benefit, so I really prefer magnesium citrate. I think one of the reasons that polycitric K is popular is because it's only available by prescription. I don't think you can prescribe such high doses of potassium by law, but magnesium you can knock yourself out with, get in the health food store. And the only side effect, which is a desirable side effect in some people, is a little bit of a laxative. But that's for many people. One of our most effective natural laxatives is to give people some magnesium citrate capsules.
Yeah. The mechanism of action also for citric acid with kidney stones is that it keeps the stone from accumulating. It keeps it from getting larger. And this is to be differentiated from ascorbic acid, which is vitamin C.
Which actually helps if you have uric acid stones, which is the less common type, then actually vitamin C helps. But vitamin C is less good for calcium oxalate stones. Some studies suggest don't take vitamin C at all if you have calcium oxalate stones. That's been kind of controversial. And there are actually some studies that say that moderate amounts of vitamin C are okay. You know, we give patients enormous amounts of vitamin C intravenously. I mean, huge amounts. None of those patients are getting kidney stones. It's amazing. If vitamin C caused kidney stones, we would have an epidemic of kidney stones. But we're seeing no kidney stones in those patients.
Well, first of all, kidney stones most often happen in the summer when people tend to be more dehydrated. There's more of a prevalence in the summertime. Another thing is, all this calcium we've been told to take for decades without balancing it with any magnesium or vitamin D also sets up for kidney stones as well. So it's very important for those of you who are taking calcium for bone health. There's a lot more to the story. You need D, you need magnesium to make sure it's assimilated properly. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, a risk factor of just taking calcium alone may be kidney stones, especially in high doses.
By the way, there's been a lot of talk about, this is on a different subject, calcium excess and atherosclerosis. But I have to say that, you know, the latest study, and it's a big study, is what's called a meta-analysis. And what they found was that calcium consumption, contrary to some previous reports, a couple of studies from New Zealand, mostly from one guy, who seems to have a little bit of an attitude toward supplements. He also puts down vitamin D. That calcium intake was not associated with higher risk of cardiovascular disease. So
calcium intake from food or from supplements?
Calcium intake overall. Overall.
Overall. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So, look, I mean, I don't think people should. There used to be a mania for calcium. People would chew Tums all day long in an effort to get the calcium into their bones, and I think that's a mistake.
My mother did that.
That's a mistake. It's a mistake. I mean, you don't need to do that, and B, there may be harmful effects, especially when, as you say, don't balance it. But the latest is that I don't think, you know, it's an overblown concern that calcium that you take orally finds its way inevitably into your coronary arteries.
Yeah.
I don't think that that's so much the case.
Okay, so getting back to Hope in Johannesburg, it's helpful to know the type of stones, whether they're calcium oxalate stones,
right,
which is more prevalent, the uric acid stones, which are less prevalent. So, in terms of treatment.
And
thank
by the way, notwithstanding mm-hmm. my previous comments, Hope, we do realize that you speak English in South Africa.
I did not translate that from.
No, that was not. We know that you're not speaking Boer, or you're not speaking, Swahili, or you know what.
I've got another one. Do we have time, Dr.
Indeed,
Hoffman?
Yeah.
Yes. This is from Ben. Hi, Dr. Hoffman and Layla. I just finished an excellent autobiography by Anthony Kiedis of the Red Hot Chili Peppers, who touts...
Ooh, I like the Red Hot Chili Peppers.
I love the Red Hot Chili Peppers. I love their brand of funk. They're wonderful.
What's your favorite song?
Suck My Kiss. Sorry.
their lyrics are kind of edgy, especially some of
they
the
are,
later lyrics.
Yeah.
But the music is really great.
You can't help moving to the music, which is a wonderful thing about funk.
Right.
Anyway, so Anthony Kiedis touts the virtues of intravenous ozone treatments. He claims it helped tame his recreational drug cravings, in addition to curing his hepatitis C infection. What is your opinion of ozone?
That's a really interesting question. So here's this rock star, and he's got hepatitis C, and probably we know how he got that, you know, maybe from a little bit of intravenous drug use.
Sure.
Or could have been sexually transmitted. We don't know. But intravenous ozone, I've done a lot of research on intravenous ozone. I was quite interested in the subject in the 1980s, and I actually traveled to Germany on a fact-finding mm-hmm. mission, visiting a bunch of doctors in Germany who were using intravenous ozone. And many of them really raved about it. They really said it was very helpful for cancer, for infectious diseases. One doctor that I visited, being a typical German, he liked to go to bars and drink, drive fast cars too. I mean, it's kind of...
There's
no speed limit there. So he had a collection of BMWs, and he used to drive his cars fast and go to bars, which is probably not a great combination. But
he
would tell me that one of his favorite things to do would be, if he had a hangover, would be to take an ozone treatment, which was highly oxygenating to his tissue and rejuvenating and energizing. And what I have to say is that the evidence for ozone, and this has been around for a long time, it hasn't developed the way I had hoped. I had hoped that there were going to be more and more studies validating it, showing that It could be a cure for HIV, for example, which we had hoped that it was going to, you know, ozone is a sanitizing substance. You can cleanse swimming pools and water supplies. Many municipalities use ozone to clean the water.
Instead of chlorine, yes.
Yeah, it kills all the harmful organisms. And the thought is that if you run it into the bloodstream, that it will kill all the bad bugs. The problem may be that a lot of bad bugs reside deep in the tissue. So even if you get to all parts of the bloodstream, you may not be able to eradicate the harmful bugs elsewhere in the body. I'm concerned about the oxidative effects of ozone. It certainly is a free radical inducing substance, although it is claimed that when you take ozone, your body adapts and you produce more antioxidants on your own, and this actually kicks up your own antioxidant capabilities. But what I guess what I'm a little bit confused about is that if it is so beneficial, why haven't there been more and better studies showing that, A, it can eradicate viruses, B, that it can zap cancer cells? There unfortunately has not been enough evidence to tip me in favor of widespread use of ozone.
Is it possibly because it's unpatentable in its clinical use somehow, or anything like that, or?
Well, certainly, yes, you're right. You're right about that. But in Europe, it seems that it is more accepted and more widely mm-hmm. used. And you would think that, say, a manufacturer of an ozone delivery system, which they are expensive, the units are expensive, would undertake some research to validate it. And I think the research, unless I'm missing something, because I actually went over there and looked at it, I can read German. I don't really see all that much new research coming through that proves the efficacy of it. I'm not saying that, and there may be patients out there anecdotally who do better with it. Unfortunately, it has not reached the threshold of, say, something like chelation therapy, which is something I've been using consistently over the past several decades, and where recently there's a big NIH study that showed it was beneficial. Intravenous vitamin C. There are now good studies that show that intravenous vitamin C works against cancer. And it may work via an oxidative mechanism. It may work because when you deliver very high doses of vitamin C, instead of being an antioxidant, it becomes a prooxidant. It generates hydrogen peroxide deep within the tissue of the body. And that, in effect, it's like an oxidative therapy, like ozone. Hydrogen peroxide, ozone, vitamin C, they may be related in their effects. But I think vitamin C, it poses less hazards. It's also generally... And I got to say, this is important too. It's generally less under the gun of state and federal regulators. I think, you know, ozone machines have been seized by the Food and Drug Administration here in the United States. Right now, I think they exist in sort of a gray zone. There are some states that heavily persecute and prosecute doctors doing oxidative therapies. Nevada, which is a state that's sort of a free fire zone when it comes to a lot of things. You can go to, you know, the Bunny Ranch out there. You can, prostitution is legal. Also, there's more of a tolerance for various forms of...
Is prostitution legal in Nevada?
It's absolutely legal in Nevada, yes.
Oh, my goodness.
Yes, it's legal. I mean, at least maybe there's certain things that you can't do, you know, but it's under normal circumstances, it's legal. But you can go to Nevada and you can go see a prostitute, and then you can go get intravenous ozone treatment, and it's legal.
Oh my!
Okay. So that that's a little plug for the Nevada Tourist Bureau. You know, what happens here stays here. So if you, and you know, ozone is legal. But you know, I have to say I gave it a chance. I also you know, explored its use early on when I was a physician in the beginnings of the AIDS epidemic when we didn't have good drugs. You know, this new movie Dallas, what was it called, with Matthew McConaughey?
I don't know what
Dallas
it's called,
Buyers
but I know
Club.
What you're
Dallas
talking about.
Dallas Buyers Club. That was very reminiscent of the early days in my professional career when we were confronting here in New York City a lot of very sick patients with HIV, and the drugs weren't working. We tried innovative therapies. Among them were oxidative therapies like intravenous hydrogen peroxide and ozone and ultraviolet blood irradiation, because there weren't really satisfactory therapies. Now, I think, you know, to give ozone to a patient with HIV instead of a standard drug regimen, which seems to work pretty well, albeit that there are side effects, would be irresponsible. It's like, why use an experimental alternative therapy that is unproven in lieu of a you know, more well-established conventional therapy, I think that that would be irresponsible. The same thing with hepatitis C. There are treatments now, conventional treatments for hepatitis C. So, you know, look, artists and musicians, they tend to be a little eccentric in their choices, you know, also and sometimes in the medical options they pursue. And, you know, I'm not sure. I don't know. And whether it can cure you of drug addiction, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's like, how does that work?
That the drug addiction is cured. Yeah.
How does that work? I mean, it's kind of like, you know, I could say, you know, if we told someone to undergo an intense program of volleyball training, that could cure them of drug addiction. So, you know, there's maybe like an adherence effect if you do anything in a concerted way in lieu of drug use. You know, it might deter you from drug use, right?
Or I wonder if there's some kind of endorphin effect or something like that. Well, who knows? All right. Just knowing that you're being treated is enough motivation to cure the thing that got you in trouble in the first place, would think.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, it's a very interesting subject. I think I really wish that, like you say, there were more research dollars available for it. Generally, drugs that are patentable, that are made by big pharmaceutical companies, get all the attention when it comes to research. And natural substances like ozone, where the economic incentive is less great because, you know, dozens and dozens of companies can make ozone machines, and maybe it's hard to patent the process, there's less likelihood that a lot of money will be invested in research. So, you know, here's hoping that more and more of this research can be performed in an objective way, and then we'll know. We'll really know.
Okay.
Anything else going on?
Do we have any more time?
We have time for one short response. Do we have a short one?
Okay. This is actually from Richard. I have broken blood vessels on my eyelids, which came from sun damage. They are red. Is there anything you know of that might help this condition? My dermatologist said this is not blepharitis.
Okay. So this is tough because once the blood vessels have been dilated and broken, it's hard to patch them together again, I would say. But one possibility is with a category of nutrients that we know enhances capillary integrity. And I think you know what category I'm talking about, right?
Right. I'm thinking about rutin in particular.
Yeah, bioflavonoids. Bioflavonoids used to be referred to as substance P. That stood for permeability. And they reduced the permeability or leakiness of capillaries in experiments done, I believe it was in the 1930s. And so initially this group of nutrients were dubbed vitamin P, but then they were more broadly characterized as bioflavonoids. And among them are rutin and quercetin. By the way, pycnogenol fits that category.
Sure.
Pycnogenol can be also helpful for swelling and edema. Bring them on. I would definitely consider that kind of nutritional program along with vitamin C. Vitamin C seems to be a synergist with the bioflavonoids. Give it a shot. See if it works.
Give it a shot. See if it does work. Absolutely.
Right.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you know, I kind of like that look, but that look, you know, that red, you know, the red eye shade, that might work better if you were playing for the Red Hot Chili Peppers. You know, like the rock star kind of, you know, eye makeup. When you're a rock star, you can go with the eye makeup. But
absolutely, and a lot of other things too.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so great. I think that that's pretty much it for today. Remember, if you have a question, you can email us your question to a radio program at AOL.com. Please try to make it of general interest and try to make your question succinct. And if your question is selected, we will read it on the air, and Layla and I will endeavor to answer it on our weekly edition of Q&A with Layla. Thanks very much, Layla.
Thank you, Dr. Hoffman.
And I'll see you in the office soon.
Okay.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is Intelligent Medicine.